This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's important to bring into the equation when we say the greatest polluter, the most dangerous, the most long-term sustainable destruction comes from the U.S. military and is never discussed.
Patriotism. Since the birth of the nation-state, humans have equated fighting in battle on behalf of one's country as the ultimate form of patriotism. But the U.S. military is far and away the planet's biggest polluting force. Given the looming threat of climate change, perhaps it's time we recognize environmental stewardship as the more patriotic undertaking. This week on Sea Change Radio, I talk with author and activist Sarah Flounders about the pollution and environmental devastation that continues to be wreaked by the greatest fighting force the world has ever known. How do we break this bellicose cycle of using resources to destroy human life and degrade the Earth? Can the green movement somehow become the new face of patriotism? And what exactly does Mother Nature need to tell us until we finally understand that war is not the answer? I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sarah Flounders. She's a political organizer, activist, and author. Her new book is Wars Without Victory, The Pentagon's Achilles Heel. Sarah, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be here talking.
We've wanted to have you on for quite some time to discuss the environmental impact of the military. How did you learn about this? This is not something that's a direct connection. Most people don't think of the U.S. military as the world's worst polluter on the planet, but they are.
Very much so. I think at the time of the UN climate change conference in Copenhagen, I started really following this question and began to think about, well, why is the question of the military not even being raised? Here's environmentalists from around the world, and no one is even discussing the impact of U.S. wars. And it was really through that that I found that, and you know, when you go researching or looking at a topic, mainly I had been as an organizer against U.S. wars, but when you start researching, you can really connect the dots. So there's a great deal of material to say they really are the largest international user of petroleum products and energy, and yet they have an exemption from all the international climate change agreements.
I want to drill into that later because that's an important topic unto itself. But let's first set the stage. In 1940, the U.S. military consumed approximately 1% of the country's total energy use. By the end of World War II, that share had risen to 29%. So that just shows you that the scope of a major war effort like that really was based on energy consumption, that all of these machines to quote-unquote defend our borders are big users of fossil fuel. Do you have any estimates on what percentage the U.S. military consumes now?
Just in this one article I did, that said the military officially uses 320,000 barrels of oil a day. And that doesn't include a lot of other figures in there about privatized facilities and leased facilities and so on. But that's just what the military itself actually uses. Well, we could look at it this way. There's 1,000 U.S. bases around the world. There's 6,000 facilities here in the U.S. There's NATO operations. There's the aircraft carriers and all of the weapons testing and training and equipment all around the world. The U.S. Navy has 285 combat and support ships, and there's 4,000 operational aircraft. All of these are using, of course, enormously polluting. An aircraft carrier uses about what a small city in the U.S. would use. Or another figure I saw uses about what the city of Detroit would use.
One aircraft carrier?
They're enormous, enormous users of carbon dioxide, of petroleum products, of course, oil, but all the equipment on board and all the jets, let's say, that take off from an aircraft. I mean, you have on it thousands of military personnel, and they're all using an enormous amount of equipment, which are using great deal of energy. And they're also, by the way, there's a lot of toxic emissions also. But the military has, you know, hundreds of thousands of vehicles. That's 140,000 multi-purpose wheeled vehicles and thousands of helicopters and so on, fleet vehicles. So all of this equipment, which is none of it environmentally sound, and that is even before the shooting starts. There's a very interesting book on this, Bernie Sanders' book, The Green Zone, The Environmental Costs of Militarism. Mm-hmm. And just to quote from him, he said, the greatest single assault on the environment, on all of us around the globe, comes from one agency, the Armed Forces of the United States. Just to give you some quotes on this, Steve Ketzman, the director of Oil Change International, said that the Iraq war was responsible for at least 141 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. And that war emitted more than 60% in terms of carbon dioxide of all countries combined. So you see the enormous pollution, destruction, of course, to people on the ground, people who are under the bombs, people for whom the electric grid and the water, the sanitation, the sewage is destroyed. But it's also a good example that these wars come home. They pollute the air and the land and the water. And they use an incredible, fantabulous amount of fossil fuels.
I also read an article by, it was in Truth Out, and Barry Sanders, no relation to the Hall of Fame football player, I imagine. He estimates that the U.S. military consumes as much as 1 million barrels of oil per day and contributes 5% of current global warming emissions. But it sounds like this is all very fuzzy math. We just know that it's a lot.
Yeah, Barry Sanders, that's who I was just referring to. He's the author of The Green Zone, The Environmental Costs of Militarism. And he has a wealth of information. I mean, he really describes on every level, the weapon systems themselves.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to political activist and author Sarah Flounders. No, this is obviously an international problem. This is not unique to the Pentagon, but you had mentioned that the U.S. military has a blanket exemption in international climate agreements. Is that just the U.S. military, or when we're talking about climate change treaties like the Kyoto Protocol, are all militaries usually exempt from being part of that carbon equation, or just the U.S.?
Just the U.S. and the U.S. commanded, equipped NATO operations.
How do they rationalize that to the rest of the world? Or how does the rest of the world buy into that?
There's no rationality. It's something that's not commonly known, but it was agreed to as a provision for the U.S. to sign the Kyoto Accords, and then they didn't sign. After having been granted the exemption as a condition of signing, they then didn't sign. So, and yet, nevertheless, that agreement went forth into all emissions counts and so on into the future. So it really means that the two areas who are the largest polluters, the U.S. and Europe.
And China.
And China. But in terms of the military emissions, if that were counted in, of course, it would be far, far higher. So what it shows is that it makes it appear that countries in the developing world are more highly polluting. And there's a lot of pollution coming from there because that is the cost, the impact with the way industrialization takes place today. Every country trying to aggressively industrialize makes decisions that impact the whole planet. But so also does the military. And by taking that out of the equation, you end up with an absolutely distorted measurement.
So the arm twisting that the U.S. did during the 1997 negotiations of the Kyoto Protocol, even though they didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol, that continues today. And if they ever did sign a similar treaty, we would probably expect that to be in place since they've already kind of negotiated that loophole. Is that right?
Yes, that loophole is already in place. And even with that loophole in place, for example, in Copenhagen and since, they've also refused to sign any agreement. But it makes the U.S. measurement substantially less. And it should call into question a lot. You wonder what other secret agreements have been made with countries around the world in order to get them to sign on to treaties that are really a fig leaf in terms of grappling with the real problems.
Tell me, my darling son, pray tell me what they've done. How is it that you come to be this way? As he tried his best to talk, but his mouth could hardly move, and his mother had to turn her face away. Don't you remember, Ma, when I went off to war? You thought it was the best thing I could do. I was on the battleground, you were home acting proud. Thank God you wasn't standing in my shoes. 'Cause I thought when I was there, God, what am I doing here? I'm trying to kill somebody or die trying. But the thing that scared me most is when my enemy came so close and I saw that his face looked just like mine. Lord, Lord, just like mine.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to political activist and author Sarah Flounders. As a keen observer of the military and the environmental impact of the military, what do you make of the military's quote-unquote efforts to green itself?
It's a fraud. It's just a public relations. And it's the same kind of public relations every year as the military budget increases. It's issued with a press release projecting out 10 years that the cost of militarism will decline, which it never does. And the next year there's another increase and then it declines. So the same thing with, there are some measures being taken for greater fuel efficiency, and they'll do things like light bulbs and so on.
And they have solar panels that are thin solar panels that like a soldier can carry now, as opposed to carrying these big, expensive, and heavy batteries on them.
Right.
Sarah, we recently had David Roberts from Grist, who was on talking about the military efforts to use alternative fuels and the Republican efforts in Congress to block them from being able to use biofuels and other alternative energy sources. Now, you'd said that these green efforts were largely a fraud and fair enough, but I couldn't help but think that just at least beginning that dialogue and having us start to look at the military in a different way than rather than just protecting us, that actually they are a consumer of fossil fuels, and it was an important discussion to have. And I couldn't help but think that that could be a nice first step in more transparency in our Pentagon and their environmental impacts.
Yes, it is. I don't want to disparage it. I was really addressing the question of, it's such a tiny, almost insignificant amount. Now, I think there are forces that are against even that, because they're against anything in the military being held accountable to demands for cleanup, demands for another way of doing things. But the idea that the U.S. military can become a green institution when really what it's about doing is spreading power and doing it through mass destruction, that's where I say that whether the military is green or not, their purpose is to destroy the countries and really make life unlivable for the people there when a war is waged.
Let's talk about the lack of political will to try to rein in the military. We have the largest war machine the world has ever seen, and yet I saw just yesterday Dick Cheney is out there lobbying his colleagues in Congress to make it a political talking point for this election that we can't afford any military cutbacks in any way.
Well, this is, and it's important to understand it's a problem of both political parties. That throughout the Obama administration, too, and through the Clinton years, the military continues to grow year after year. And the amount of resources that it uses, the amount of wars expand. We now have nonstop drone wars underway. Pakistan being hit every day now in an undeclared war. The threat of new war, Syria, Iran. So regardless of how the political leaders are speaking, there are huge institutional apparatuses in play, very much tied between the banks, the military, and the oil corporations. And war is enormously profitable for them. A growing military, enormous, greatest source of profit, of guaranteed subsidies. And this goes on regardless of the administration, the political party that's in office, more consciously put forward and formulated by the Republicans. But it doesn't really change in a Democratic administration either.
Coming out of World War II, the U.S. had one of its great economic booms. And also, the economy did fairly well in some measures, not in terms of income equality, but in the Reagan years, the recession ended, at least. And that was in the face of large military spending. So it seems like a lot of the takeaways from the economic minds in Congress and their advisors is that military spending of any kind, and if it just happens to be military, which is good politically because it creates jobs all across these different constituencies, it can somehow stimulate the economy. And is that really what happened in the 50s? Was it because of the big scale-up for World War II that led to these greener pastures?
Very much so. There's a kind of military Keynesianism that since the Depression, the solution to the Depression of the largest corporations was these giant government subsidies for war. And, of course, World War II was that huge boom that blasted their way out of the Depression and into the U.S. being the great superpower. And in the years since, in the 50s and the 60s, and Vietnam War, Korean War, each war was a big boost for the U.S. economy. But the thing is, militarism is like a drug, and like a drug addict, big stimulant in the beginning, and then dependency on it. It becomes an absolute drain. There is a saturation, and it no longer solves the economic problems that it was once meant to. And as a matter of fact, more and more money comes out of every other area of the economy and out of life in the U.S. So you have an educational level where we're 24th on the world scale and the number one military superpower. More money is taken out of and cut directly from cities, from essential programs for seniors, for children, for nutrition, for the environment, for infrastructure, for bridges and tunnels and roads, for the electric grid here, for the introducing green technology. There's no real money being put into that in any substantial way. It all goes into the tracks already set of the military corporations, Let's build a new aircraft carrier. Let's have a new super jet. Let's have a new stealth bomber. Let's invest it in cruise missiles, new kind of landmine. So more and more and more goes into the military. They can't live without it, and it is taken from every area of the economy, and it no longer does the trick in terms of boosting the economy.
I got your letter today, and I miss you all so much here. I can't wait to see you all, and I'm counting the days here. I still believe that there's gold at the end of the world, and I'll come home to Illinois on the day after tomorrow. It is so hard and it's cold here, and I'm tired of taking orders, and I miss orders.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to political activist and author Sarah Flounders. The military corporations have been very... I don't know if this is the way they planned it originally, but it's definitely worked to their strategic advantage to have so many jobs all across the country to make just one vehicle or plane. And so the political fallout of that is, like you said earlier, in that there is no political affiliation towards this militarism. Democrats and Republicans alike are equally guilty of voting for this continued escalation and spending, because they would be job killers in the eyes of their constituents if they vote against it.
See, that's a good example of the fraudulent public relations way in which militarism and war is sold, because the jobs are actually far fewer in the high fields. They have all these National Priorities Project has issued one graph after another showing that the same amount of money would hire 10 times as many teachers, social workers.
It's like the Excel pipeline or something. You can look at it. The math can be manipulated any way you want, but it can be used as a political weapon against somebody. So even somebody like John Kerry, who had already seen the perils of war, and he and others in the Senate were voting to keep, was it the B-2 bomber or one of the bombers recently? I'm forgetting the B. It was a B something bomber that the Pentagon had recommended squashing. And they said, we wanted to shelve this project, and the Senate wouldn't allow them. That's when you know that things are definitely bass-ackwards.
Yeah. There's money in it, and they end up... And that money is a guaranteed subsidy to the big corporations. So I just wanted to also touch on things that aren't really thought of, even when we talk about the rates of pollution of the military. But we need to sort of have a whole picture of what happens with when you're the largest seller, distributor of landmines and of cluster bombs, with the delayed explosion and the maiming and the disabling that happens. It's a highly toxic, it's radioactive materials into the air, it's depleted uranium weapons that are used so such an enormous way, both toxic and radioactive weapons, that all of these things stay in the soil. It's the Agent Orange still in Vietnam, still poisoning a generation and two, and now into the third generation, with the herbicides that were spread. It is the destruction of Iraq went from being a grain exporter to today more than 80% of their food is imported. So it's complete and 90% of the land, they say, is now in Iraq, facing severe desertification.
So there's a good chance that Iraq will be the next Vietnam in terms of the, we can see a direct link in Vietnam where there's dioxin and contamination and birth defects and cancer rates that are 300-400 times higher than regular levels.
Right, right. Certainly in Iraq and for the soldiers coming back. So here you have an area that which for 5,000 years of human history was breadbasket and now is both importing its food and facing an environmental catastrophe in its land. And in the water, even if the food is imported, certainly the air you breathe and the water you drink is not. So all of this is an impact that we need to see, just like the fallout years and generations and far into the future of nuclear testing from an earlier age, what that did in the South Pacific, what it did in the Southwest and the U.S. It's important to bring into the equation when we say the greatest polluter, the most dangerous, the most long-term sustainable destruction comes from the U.S. military and is never discussed, never really challenged because of the power that they exert and the profits in the corporations that are tied to the military. So it means that the political leaders don't challenge that until there is a cleanup a generation after, a base has shut down, for example.
Yeah, it's hard to have a green way of blowing things up.
Exactly, exactly.
So you're a political activist in addition to being an author. Tell us some of the ways that people can get involved to try to change the status quo.
Well, I think the focus is why I make the focus on the military, because I do think that bringing this, the role of the military, the role of U.S. wars, the role of the concentration of banking and oil and military corporations together, challenging that is an important way to educate people and an important way to focus the whole discussion. And an important way to say here that all the small steps matter, people recycling, doing all sorts of measures. But unless there's real sustained education on the role of the military itself, it won't help. It won't go anywhere. So I really would urge people to become more familiar with and to make the links of the impact of U.S. wars and what it is doing here at home and what it's doing to the planet as a whole, along with the countries themselves that are the target. I think that would be an important way to build greater consciousness and to make a more serious challenge.
Sarah Flounders, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Funkadelic, Bob Dylan, and Tom Waits. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.